There is a photograph that aviation people pass around like a holy relic. Black and white, probably mid-1950s, taken from slightly below and behind the aircraft. You can see the full silhouette against a pale sky, that unmistakable triple tail. The long, graceful curve of the fuselage, rising toward the nose and sweeping back down like a wave. Four big radial engines hanging off a wing that seems almost impossibly perfect in its proportions. People who see that photograph for the first time, people who didn't grow up in the era of piston airliners, they always ask the same question. What is that? That, my friend, is the Lockheed Constellation, and it is, without argument, the most beautiful aircraft ever to carry paying passengers. I'm Tail Dragger. You're listening to The Hangar on Radio Hangar. Pull up a chair, because this story deserves to be told slowly. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight, first solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. Now, let's go back to 1939. The world's airlines are flying the Douglas DC-3. It's a magnificent airplane. We covered the DC-3 here not long ago, and it has transformed commercial aviation, but it has limits. It cannot cross the continent nonstop. It cannot cross the Atlantic without multiple fuel stops, and the men running the major airlines are already thinking about what comes next. One of those men isn't exactly running an airline. He's more like haunting one. Howard Hughes. Hughes had acquired a controlling interest in Transcontinental and Western Air, TWA. And he had the kind of obsessive, restless intelligence that couldn't leave a problem alone. He didn't want an incremental improvement on the existing hardware. He wanted something nobody had ever seen. An airliner that could fly coast to coast without stopping. Passengers arriving rested and comfortable, and he wanted the whole thing to be beautiful, because Howard Hughes believed that beautiful things flew better, whether or not that's aerodynamically sound. He wasn't entirely wrong about this particular airplane. Hughes approached Lockheed. He'd worked with them before on his own record-setting flights, and he trusted their people. At the time, Lockheed's advanced design group was led by a young engineer you might have heard of, Clarence Kelly Johnson. Johnson would go on to build the Skunk Works and give the world the U-2 and the SR-71 Blackbird. But in 1939, he was 33 years old and already one of the best aircraft designers alive. Hughes and Johnson made an unlikely pair. Hughes was mercurial, demanding, impossible to schedule, and sometimes impossible to reach for weeks at a time. Johnson was methodical, direct, and not particularly interested in input from people who weren't engineers. But they shared one thing, an absolute intolerance for mediocrity. The requirements Hughes laid out were audacious for the era. The new airliner needed to carry 40 passengers. It needed to cruise at better than 300 miles per hour. It needed a pressurized cabin so passengers could ride at altitude in shirt-sleeve comfort without fighting hypoxia or wearing oxygen masks. And it needed the range to fly New York to Los Angeles nonstop. Nothing like it existed anywhere in the world. Lockheed took the contract. Kelly Johnson's team went to work. And what they designed over the next 2 years was unlike anything the airline industry had ever seen. The fuselage. That famous dolphin shape. If you've ever looked at a Constellation up close, the fuselage doesn't run straight from nose to tail. It curves. The aircraft sits with its tail low to the ground and its nose tilted slightly upward, giving it a sense of motion even standing still on the ramp. The curve wasn't purely aesthetic, though. It was functional. The nose had to ride high enough to give the nose wheel room to retract. The tail had to sweep down far enough to give the big propellers ground clearance. The pressurized fuselage was a triple bubble cross-section, three overlapping circles that gave structural strength and enough interior width for two seats on each side of a center aisle, and then there was the tail. The Constellation's triple tail is one of the most recognizable silhouettes in aviation history. Three identical fins and rudders arranged side by side, like a crown. People often assume this was a stylistic choice, an aesthetic flourish. It was not. It was a practical solution to a practical problem. A single conventional tail on an aircraft this large would have been enormous, too tall for the hangar doors at most airports of the era. Three smaller tails delivered the same control authority, kept the aircraft low enough to fit where it needed to fit, and happened to look absolutely spectacular in the process. That is Kelly Johnson's signature. Solving hard problems in ways that also happened to be beautiful. The engines were four Wright R3350 duplex cyclone radials, 18 cylinders each, arranged in two rows of nine. Each engine produced around 2,200 horsepower at takeoff, driving three-bladed Hamilton Standard propellers with a diameter of 15 feet. When all four of those engines lit up and came to power on the run-up pad, the noise was, There is no other word for it. Magnificent. Not the thin, clean whine of a turbine. A deep rolling thunder that you felt in your chest before you heard it with your ears. The military ordered the Constellation as a troop transport, designated the C-69 before the civilian version ever flew. The first flight was January 9, 1943, at Lockheed Air Terminal in Burbank, California. The aircraft performed beautifully from the start, but the civilian version, the one Hughes and TWA had ordered, was sitting on the tarmac. Wartime priorities meant commercial aviation wasn't getting new hardware, and Hughes, being Hughes, couldn't wait. In April of 1944, Hughes and TWA President Jack Fry decided they were going to make a point. They took a C-69, technically a military aircraft, and flew it from Burbank to Washington, D.C. They covered roughly 2,300 miles in 6 hours and 57 minutes at an average speed of 331 miles per hour, a new transcontinental speed record. Hughes typically made sure someone important was along for the ride. He had invited the legendary aviator Jimmy Doolittle, and this is the part that stops me every time I think about it, Orville Wright himself. The man who had made the first powered flight at Kitty Hawk in 1903 was 72 years old. He sat in the flight deck of a pressurized 4-engine airliner and crossed the continent in under 7 hours. Orville Wright, who had flown 120 feet in 12 seconds 41 years earlier, sitting in the cockpit of a machine that could cross America at cruise. He reportedly said it was the longest flight he'd ever taken. Aviation moves fast. Sometimes it moves so fast it takes your breath away. After the war ended, the military C-69s were released for conversion to airline use. The L-049 Constellation, the first commercial variant, began service with TWA in February of 1946. Pan American started flying them at almost the same time. Almost overnight, the Constellation became the flagship of the transatlantic route. What was it like to board a Constellation in 1947? Close your eyes. You've arrived at the gate at Idlewild Airport in New York. You're wearing your good clothes because this is an occasion. Flying is an occasion. The aircraft outside the windows is gleaming silver. TWA's red lettering running down the fuselage. The 4 engines are already running. That deep radial rumble vibrating through the plate glass. A ground agent in uniform walks you across the ramp. You climb the air stairs inside. The cabin is hushed, real seats with real legroom. Overhead panels lit warmly. Big oval windows, through them you can see the ramp lights catching puddles on the wet tarmac. A stewardess offers you a newspaper and a pillow. The door closes. The engines build to a roar. The aircraft rolls, accelerates, and then lifts. That nose-high attitude, those big props clawing the air, and beneath you, New York falls away into a galaxy of lights. And you are flying to London, not hopping, not island jumping across the North Atlantic, with fuel stops at Gander and Shannon every 4 hours, London overnight. That crossing took 17 to 19 hours, depending on the winds, 17 hours in a pressurized cabin at altitude, cruising at 20,000 feet above the weather, eating real food off real plates, sleeping in a seat that reclined. Compare that to what transatlantic travel had been a week on a ship, and before that, well, most people simply didn't go to London. The Constellation didn't just change commercial aviation. It changed the world's sense of its own geography. Now here's where it gets interesting, because the Constellation story is not entirely triumph. Those Wright R-350 engines, magnificent on paper. In practice, they were among the most troublesome power plants ever hung on an airliner. The duplex cyclone had a tendency to run hot, to throw oil, and in the worst cases, to catch fire. Engine fires were a genuine and recurring problem in Constellation operations throughout the late 1940s. Several accidents, some of them fatal, cast a shadow over the program. The airlines worked with Wright and Lockheed to address the problems. They changed oil formulations, modified cooling baffles, refined the fire suppression systems, but the R-350 never fully shook its reputation. Constellation crews learned to manage the engines with a kind of constant professional vigilance. The drill for an engine fire was precise and demanding. Fuel shut off, feather the prop, fire suppression, identify the failed engine, maintain aircraft control and performance. Old Connie captains will tell you they ran that checklist in their sleep because sometimes you had to run it in the middle of the night over the North Atlantic with 300 miles of black water in every direction. And they kept flying it because despite its temperament, the Constellation was a remarkable aircraft to handle. Stable and predictable. It flew with genuine precision. The old captains who flew it loved it the way you love something that demands respect and then rewards it. Lockheed kept developing the airframe. The L-749 added fuel capacity and range. The L-1049 Super Constellation. This is where it gets really interesting. Stretched the fuselage by nearly 19 feet, added more capable engines, and gave the aircraft room for up to 99 passengers. the superconstellation became the workhorse of the long-haul piston era. Every major international airline had them. TWA, Pan American, Eastern Air France, KLM, Lufthansa, Qantas. If you were flying long-haul in the 1950s, you were probably riding a Connie. The military kept developing it too. The Navy's version, the WV-2 Warning Star, later redesignated the EC-121, became one of the first airborne early warning platforms in history. The Navy flew them over the Atlantic and Pacific with massive radar domes mounted above and below the fuselage, watching for Soviet bombers before they ever reached the coast. They flew missions in Korea and Vietnam. That distinctive Constellation airframe, with its triple tail and dolphin fuselage, was pulling radar duty in combat zones while its sisters were carrying tourists to Paris. And then came the L-1649 Starliner. The Starliner is the final and most capable member of the Constellation family. It flew with an entirely new wing, longer, thinner, more aerodynamically refined, and the most advanced engines Wright had ever built in that series. The Starliner could fly from New York to London nonstop. Against the headwinds on the westbound crossing, it could make London to Los Angeles with a single fuel stop. The Starliner entered service in 1957. It was the pinnacle of piston airliner development, the most capable propeller-driven transport aircraft ever built, and it arrived with terrible timing. The Boeing 707 entered service in October of 1958. The Douglas DC-8 followed. Within 5 years, the jet transition was essentially complete on the major international routes. The Starliner, which had been flying commercially for barely a year, found itself obsolete. There is something genuinely melancholy in that. The finest achievement of the piston era, overtaken before it ever had a chance to reach its full potential. Airlines sold off their Connies and Starliners to secondary carriers and cargo operators. The big jets took the prime routes. The Constellation soldiered on for another decade and more, in the fleets of smaller airlines, charter operators, freight companies, flying routes the jets hadn't bothered to claim yet. The last commercial passenger operations wound down in the 1970s. But here's what I love about this community. Pilots and mechanics and restoration volunteers never let the great aircraft disappear entirely. There are Constellations flying today. Not many, but they exist. Restoration groups in Europe and the United States have poured extraordinary resources and decades of labor into keeping examples airworthy. The Planes of Fame Museum at Chino Airport in California has an example. The National Air and Space Museum has a Super Constellation at their annex at Dulles. The Constellation Historical Society, a volunteer organization of dedicated aviation historians, has been documenting and supporting restoration work for years. The sound of four R3-350 duplex cyclones at cruise power is a sound that shouldn't be allowed to disappear from the earth. If you ever get the chance to see a Constellation flying at an air show, stop whatever you're doing, find a clear view of the runway, watch it taxi out. That low-slung fuselage riding close to the ground, the three tails tracking in a line. Watch those 15-foot props bite the air and the aircraft accelerate. Watch the nose rise into that characteristic climb attitude and the triple tail track upward against the sky. You are watching the machine that made the world smaller, the machine that took the ocean crossing from a week of uncertainty aboard a ship to a single long night in a comfortable seat, arriving at a new continent with a cup of coffee and a newspaper, back when AVGIS was cheap and airspace was free and four big radials. On a winter morning were all the reminder you needed of why you started flying in the first place. My sources today include Lockheed's Historical Archives, the Constellation Historical Society, and Robert Serling's History of Transworld Airlines, more at radiohangar.com. I'm Tail Dragger. Keep the shiny side up.